This is Central Time. A University of Wisconsin-Madison group has completed a 6-year exploration of vintage nitrate film stock in an effort to preserve the century-old movies.
Mary Hilsbeck is Assistant Director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. She's here to tell us about the Wisconsin Nitrate Film Project. Mary, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, when I heard about a Wisconsin Nitrate Film Project, I thought it's like on agricultural nutrients. This was new and different to me. What is nitrate film and when was it used?
Yeah, so nitrate film stock was the first flexible film base, and it was developed in the late 1880s. Kodak started producing it in 1889. It's made out of nitrocellulose, which is a highly flammable compound, and camphor, which was used as a plasticizer. And it was used not only for motion picture film, but also for X-ray film in the early part of the 20th century, as well as still photography negatives.
Right, because there were specific chemical demands, right, to make a movie on something. It had to be transparent, and you had to have images be able to adhere to it. And I guess in those ways, this kind of stock fit the bill.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the best that they had at that time.
But as I understand it, the job of a projectionist with this stuff could actually be dangerous.
Yeah, nitrate was flammable. If it got caught in a projector, it could ignite and start a fire very quickly. So you had to have special training, and then the booths also had to have special safety protections.
And for similar reasons, I guess, this was very hard to preserve.
Yes and no. I mean, there are some nitrate prints from the 1890s, early 1900s that are still in really great condition.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But then others that have deteriorated very quickly. It depends very much on how it's stored, the temperature, humidity, as well as how much it was used.
Well, tell us about the Nitrate Film Project here in Wisconsin. Now, what did you set out to do?
Sure. So in 2008, Heather Heckman, who was a PhD student at the time in Comm Arts and also an archives assistant at the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research and the Wisconsin Historical Society, agreed to research the claims about nitrate's combustibility and decomposition that had not only informed archival practice, but also safety standards for many years. And she found that those regulations and practices were based on research that was sometimes inconsistent and inconclusive. So she wrote a grant with the help of Professor Mahesh Mahanthapa, who was in the chemistry department at the time, and Katie Mullen from the Historical Society to the NEH to fund a 2-year study of nitrate film. And we got that grant in 2011, and the project started in 2012.
And how? What kind of films, what kind of movies are out there only on this old nitrate stock that if we don't get them onto something else, we're going to lose?
Really, anything that you would shoot today, you can find on nitrate. So feature films, short films, newsreels. If you were wealthy enough or lucky enough to have access, you could shoot home movies on 35mm nitrate. Itinerant filmmaker, so really anything and everything.
And how much have we lost that we're not going to be able to preserve?
Yeah, so the Library of Congress estimates that 75% of all silent films have been lost. Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation puts that number at 90%. So either way, it's really disheartening how much has been lost.
So are you working to try to get a hold of some of these and transfer them into another medium?
We have a small collection of nitrate film, and we have gotten several grants from the National Film Preservation Foundation the past few years to have new prints made of these and to preserve them. One of them is a 1914 itinerant film made in Wausau. Another is a home movie from Madison. So,
and I understand there was a version, a sort of a Little Rascals ripoff set in Madison to promote local businesses?
Yeah, that's called Our Own Gang in Madison, and that was made in the 30s. It was sponsored by the Wisconsin State Journal, I believe. And it's a bunch of kids running all over town, highlighting different businesses in Madison.
Talk about the historical value. I mean, because I want to see the one from Wausau and the one from Madison already, but talk about the historical value of these Wisconsin ones that you're trying to preserve.
Yeah, I mean, they really document life at a time and in a way that we don't find any place else. You know, there may be photographs of businesses in Wausau and in downtown Madison, but it's different seeing them on film. And both of those films have been preserved through the National Film Preservation Foundation, and you can watch those on our Internet Archive page.
So what do you end up preserving them on? I'm assuming something less flammable.
Yeah, polyester film is now the preservation standard for film. So we have a brand new negative for both of those films, as well as a brand new 35 millimeter print, so we could project those, as well as a digital file.
Is a film festival in the works? That'd be a lot of fun.
Well, we actually showed our own gang at the Wisconsin Film Festival a few years ago, and we've also done a screening of The Lumberjack. But yeah, we would love to show those anytime.
And what's next for the project?
The project is over. The funding is done, but all of our results and methodology are up on our website, so you can find out more, and hopefully another scientist will come along and pick up the ball and continue the research.
I don't want to say carry the torch because it's still flammable, but pick up the baton,
yes,
let's say.
Yes.
And what's that website, Mary?
WCFTR.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Mary Hilsbeck, Assistant Director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. We've been talking about the Wisconsin Nitrate Film Project and efforts to preserve these older movies, short and long, on nitrate film stock based here in Wisconsin. I want to check out some of these films myself.
Absolutely. It sounds so interesting. And coming up, we'll also find out how Packers fans are reacting to some big news, to the team's request to join their national anthem demonstration for tonight's game.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. The Green Bay Packers are playing the Chicago Bears tonight, but the game isn't all that viewers will be watching. The Packers invited their fans to join them in their national anthem demonstration as a show of unity today.
In a statement, players said they would be linking arms during the anthem to stand for tolerance and justice for people who have faced inequality. The call to fans follows a weekend of controversy after President Trump criticized players who used the field to protest. Here's a bit of the president's speech earlier. It contains language some might find offensive.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired!
Aaron Nagler is a digital producer for PackersNews.com and is currently in Green Bay. He joins us to take a closer look at that story. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Aaron, what's your sense of how Packers fans are reacting to that invitation from the Packers?
Well, it's really twofold, as you might expect. I think people are split very much on their ideological lines. I've heard from people who are very upset. My inbox has been very full. My Twitter feed has been filled up with people who are very upset with the Packers that they would even think to be doing any kind of demonstration during the anthem. And then on the other side, I've also heard from lots of people who are very supportive, who actually wish the Packers would go further and actually take knees. So I think much, a lot like the rest of the country, every kind of walk of life at this point is, politics has kind of seeped into our everyday lives in ways that we didn't really kind of experience even 5 years ago. It's really touched a nerve. So I think, like I said, Packer fans, they are a representative of society, and they are as split as society is at the moment.
Now, Packers tight end Martellus Bennett was one of the earliest players to back the protest. What has he said about what compelled him to demonstrate?
Well, he's a loquacious guy. He's always kind of holding court in the locker room, and he has talked a lot about it. His brother is a little bit more famous, Michael Bennett. He's a defensive end for the Seattle Seahawks, a little more famous for taking this stand. But Martellus has made it very clear that he is supportive of his brother, supportive of the cause. But I thought he made a good point yesterday when we were talking to him in the locker room about the furor over the protests. And, he pointed out that as this has gone on, especially with the president's comments, this has really turned into us versus them, and the idea that the players are disrespecting the military is what a lot of people have glommed onto. That's the anger that I've really heard and read email-wise from readers. But in Martellus's point, and I think it's a good one, is all of this kind of takes away from the entire point that Colin Kaepernick, who obviously instigated all this, was making when he first knelt during the anthem. Kaepernick was quoted saying, he knelt as a sign of respect for the people that, you know, were who have died for the flag, who do represent the country. But he also felt that he couldn't salute a flag where in a country where there are, you know, great injustices and people are oppressed. And I think the moment you say that, people get uncomfortable. People who have no familiarity with those experiences, you know, they kind of shut down and they don't want to talk about it because it's very uncomfortable. And that's the point Martellus made yesterday. He said people are changing the conversation because they're uncomfortable with this conversation. I think that's a very astute point. I think that's exactly what's happened here over the course of the last week.
You know, it's interesting in Wisconsin, politics, very polarized, but it seems as though everybody can agree on football. Are you hearing from people in Wisconsin or outside or both?
Both. Mostly in Wisconsin, I will say that. I've heard from a lot of people, and it's funny, the more angry the email, the more angry the contact, the phone call, what have you, I find the older the person is. I've gotten a lot of, I've been watching the Packers for 50 years. I've been watching the Packers for 45 years. Almost all of them start that way, the emails that I've read. And I understand that, you know. I don't think I think it's a very generational. I think there's a large swath of people who have no concept of maybe some of the injustices that these African-American players are talking about. It's just not a subject that they're very familiar with. And because of the vehicle that's been used, i.e. the anthem and the flag, they're very upset. I've had a lot of people saying they're not going to be watching the Packers anymore. They're going to be turning off the NFL for good. Now, I don't know if that's true. Obviously, I have no way of really kind of, you know, quantifying that. But the anger is very, very real. There's no doubt there.
And so there'll be a lot of eyes, a lot of cameras on the stands and the players today. Aaron Rodgers, a quarterback, has become kind of the face of this effort. He's got a lot of fans out there. Are they likely to follow him, or what do you expect from him tonight as we start to wrap up?
I think it will be, again, I think it will be a kind of a mix. I think there will be people joining, you know, linking arms like players and Rodgers have asked. I think there'll be plenty of people who also stand proudly with their hands on their heart, as they've always done. And, you know, ultimately, I really think it's going to be a bit of a non-event. I think it will be a moment. There's no doubt about it. Obviously, CBS, NFL Network, their cameras will be trained on it. There's little doubt that there will be, you know, attention paid. But, you know, once the song is over, they will put their helmets on. They'll go play football. And I think for the most part, that will be it. And I do think fans, some fans will link arms, some fans will hold, put their hands on their hearts. And that's what's great about America, is that you can make a choice.
Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Aaron Nagler is a digital reporter for PackersNews.com, joining us from Green Bay. I'm Veronica Ricker.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And coming up, we'll talk about the tax plan being promoted by President Trump and top GOP leaders.
Now, a new project out of the UW-Oshkosh is examining the successes and the challenges facing refugees who have been resettled here in the state. The study began looking at these communities in the Fox Valley.
And a new grant from WISIS Technology Foundation is allowing the project to expand into more communities, including Madison and Milwaukee, in order to get a better sense of how refugee resettlement has worked in the state.
Paul Van Auken is with us now. He's an associate professor of sociology and environmental studies at UW-Oshkosh. He's leading this study. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, what led you to want to do this study on refugees here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's kind of a fun story in that I didn't set out to do it necessarily. It's what in the academic world, I guess we would call an applied research project. We in our sociology department here at UW-Oshkosh had started a community advisory board a couple years back and invited a bunch of people that we hoped would be interested in hearing more about what we were doing and make connections for internships and potential research projects and such. So at that first meeting, quite a number of people came, heads of local nonprofits and from government agencies and such. And the head of the United Way here in the Oshkosh area suggested that the local resettlement task force committee could really use more data about the experience of resettling into the Oshkosh area on the part of newly arrived refugees. So we decided that would be an excellent project for us to take on and have our students start through a new class that we called Applied Sociology, and then it evolved from there.
And it sounds like there's a lot that we don't know about what life is like for refugees here in Wisconsin, resettled here in Wisconsin, in the short run and especially in the long run.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it was pretty compelling to hear from this the person that convenes this organization, comprised of, it's actually not an organization, that's part of the reason they're looking for someone from the outside to help compile some research, because they really didn't have the capacity, not being an organization themselves, to do it. But a coalition of organizations that are heavily involved with different elements of resettlement and still not feeling necessarily the best about their knowledge of the whole process in terms of what happens after the local resettlement agency no longer is able to work directly with the newly arrived refugees. How are they being served after that in terms of developing their English skills and occupational skills? Are they finding and being able to stick with quality housing? How are their kids doing in school? How do they feel welcomed? I mean, there are just myriad questions about, like you say, in the short term and then the longer term, how do they adjust and are they able to latch on to good jobs and contribute to Wisconsin communities and feel like they're a part of those communities?
So how are you going to do this? What are you going to be asking people who've been resettled here?
Well, we've got a process that's been underway, starting with that class, which did some surveys with the acronym that we use is Residents with Refugee Background, or RRB. And that's not just to come up with a shorthand. It's to make clear that people are not defined by their status as someone that came as a refugee, but they're people that have that as part of their background. So when we started that class in the spring of 2016, the students in that class did the first surveys with RRBs from the Oshkosh area, and then follow-up interviews with some of them. So that's our basic model, is to try to get as many surveys completed by RRBs as possible that ask questions about the whole range of experience, but in a more quantitative way, with not as much opportunity for people to delve into their stories and such, but looking at things such as what type of work are they doing now? How does their economic standing compare now to how they were doing in the country that they left? Experiences with schooling and with health issues and all kinds of things like that. And then we ask people, participants, to sit down for a bit more in-depth, open-ended interview process so we can hear more of their stories of how they feel about the resettlement process and their experience fleeing their countries because of persecution and that the whole time and then process that resulted in them ending up here in Wisconsin. And part of that method that we're excited about, but it's a bit challenging, is having people use photographs to help tell their story, which is something I've used quite a bit in past research. We call it photo elicitation, or participant-driven photo elicitation, basically asking people to take photos of, or use photos they already have, of certain things that help illustrate who they are, where they've come from, their challenges, their hopes, in a way that makes it maybe a bit easier to talk about traumatic experiences. And it tends to lead to deep interviews because people have something really concrete to focus on while they're talking to you. So that's also a part of the process.
We're talking to Paul Van Auken, Associate Professor of Sociology and Environmental Studies at UW Oshkosh. He and a class of students there are working on a project looking at the lives of refugees here in Wisconsin, people who have arrived with refugee status in the short run, and people who have been here for a fair amount of time. Paul, can you talk about the population of people with this status in the Oshkosh area in particular, in the Fox Cities?
We have an Office of World Relief that's located here in Oshkosh, and a couple years ago they opened a second office to serve the Fox Valley in Appleton after reopening their offices in 2012. And that's kind of an important part of the story. They had operated here previously, but like many resettlement agencies around the country, closed after 9/11. So a full decade, there was no resettlement agency operating here in the Fox Valley. But they reopened and started resettling newly arrived refugees in 2012. In the previous iteration, this area had a number of Hmong people that were resettled. The first starting in the late 70s, first family coming to Appleton, and then spreading out throughout the Fox Valley. So we have a sizable number of Hmong people in this region And it started with people who were resettled here, and then through chain migration, people reuniting with their families, and of course, having kids, we now have a sizable population of Hmong people in this area. Also, in the previous iteration, we had a significant but relatively small number of people from Sudan that came to this area around 15 years ago, and a smattering of people from other places. So in this study, we're not concerned with when people arrived. We're interested in talking to anyone who considers themselves a resident with refugee background, so it could be from any of these periods. In the past 5 years, the largest group that has resettled in this area is from the Congo, and that's one of the largest groups in the country, if not the largest group in the country overall. And they're fleeing war and conflict there. We also have a large number of people in the Fox Cities and in Wisconsin overall from Burma, and the Burmese conflict and the tragedy taking place has been in the news quite a bit now. We have people that have been coming for a while who are ethnic minorities there and are persecuted for different reasons, whether it's religion or simply being not in the favored ethnicity of the political military group that's in power. By far the third biggest is Iraqi people in Fox Valley, and we have a number of Iraqis throughout the state.
You mentioned a few of the different things you're going to be trying to measure. I want to key in on one area in particular, mental health and social connectedness. These are people who come from very likely traumatic backgrounds in the country they came from, arrived here with little or no possessions. They're in an alien culture. Everything, the weather, the roads, everything is different. How much are you going to try to assess mental health and whether they're feeling connected or isolated?
Yeah, that's a really important theme and an important variable that we are measuring. For all the things you already stated, they're coming as traumatized people. Another complicating factor when it comes to social connectedness, which is such a vital part of every person's life, their physical and mental health, more and more research shows, is that many of these people are coming from very collectivist-type cultures where their patterns of living in the places that they originally lived are very much oriented around social interaction. And so it's a compounding trauma, I think, for them to come here and then experience isolation because we operate so differently here in the United States. And that's something that's come up again and again in our research so far is that it's a hard adjustment to make when a person's used to going from neighbor to neighbor's house and talking or used to seeing all kinds of people on the streets all the time, to seeing empty streets and realizing that people don't socialize in the same way. You have to make appointments in American culture, and essentially the individualism of American ways of life, it can compound those problems. Some of the really neat stories, on the other hand, are related to how these folks find people to connect with, and they are able to, it seems in a lot of cases, they're able to find their people and develop their own sense of community here with, at least with people from their culture or having a similar background or religion. So in Oshkosh, for example, in the past few years, not one but two African congregations have emerged, Congolese worshiping together and seeing each other regularly that way, and the same with Sudanese. It's neat to see how mainstream churches, a Methodist one and a Lutheran one in this case, have welcomed these people in and helped them find a space where they can congregate and try to build those connections that they're sorely missing. So that's a really hugely important point. And we ask questions about mental and physical health on the survey, and also different questions that are trying to get at how well they feel in terms of being welcomed and whether they do have those sorts of connections with people from their own ethnic group, and whether they're making friendships and relationships with people who are from Wisconsin originally and that sort of thing. So we can get a sense for those sorts of things ourselves.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you bet.
Paul Van Auken is an associate professor of sociology and environmental studies at UW Oshkosh. He joined us to talk about a study he's leading that looks at the successes and the challenges facing refugee communities resettled here in Wisconsin.